Welcome to the Franziska Show podcast on JewishCoffeeHouse.com, the show where I give a voice to Jewish issues, topics, and people. I'm Franziska Frady, your host. Welcome to the Franziska Show. This is a Jewish Coffeehouse podcast, so make sure to check out the other podcasts on the network. And if you enjoy this podcast, make sure to share it with a friend or a family member or two. This is how you help support the show, and it costs $0. Today, you will be hearing from a reservist who will be sharing his story, his wisdom with us, and his experiences. And I'd like to thank Eli Nadoff, his brother, for connecting us. If you would like to join the WhatsApp chat group, please message me and I'll send you a link to join. Please be respectful in the group. And if you would like to sponsor a future episode, please do reach out. And here we go. Enjoy the show. Isaac Nadoff, it is such an honor to have you on. Thank you for your service.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, religiously, professionally. Tell us what your background is, so we get to know you a little bit, and then we'll go into the topic of the day.
Background, born in Pittsburgh, raised in Pittsburgh. Professionally, I was a Pittsburgh paramedic. I work in nursing homes. I was in the Army 10 years ago. Went back now for Miluim. I'm back now until the next call-up, which is looking to be in June.
Hopefully you're not called back because this is over.
I hate to say wishful thinking, but the way it looks, it's maybe wishful thinking, but it's the name of the game. We signed up for it and we're ready.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. You're back in Pittsburgh?
Yes.
When you say grew up in Pittsburgh, give us a little bit religious background.
I went to Yeshiva Schools of Pittsburgh until eighth grade. After that, I was in Yardley, a.k.a. Misif Devim Town, a.k.a. now they're in Lakewood for 9th and 10th grade. 11th grade, I was briefly in South Bend, Yeshiva of South Bend. That is the part that we don't really talk about.
How so?
Wasn't the right fit, and it didn't really work. And then I was there until Pesach. Pesach, I come home for Pesach, and my father picks me up from the train station, and I have a bunch of suitcases with me. And he asked me, he says, what's all this? I said, it's all my stuff. He says, why did you bring it? Because I'm not going back. And I didn't go back. That summer, I worked in Muncie. I worked for my cousin's company. We changed all of the lighting in the Palisades Mall. And then after that, 12th grade, I was in Waterbury. After Pesach, in 12th grade, I got a call from my brother, Eli. And that call led me to enlist in the Israeli Army.
What happened on that call?
So he called me up. It was around 2 p.m. Forgot what day. Let's say it was a Tuesday. I picked up and I sounded tired. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm in bed. He said, why are you in bed? Because he just got back from Shear and you're taking a nap. I said, no, I didn't feel like getting out today. I just was staying by watching movies the whole day. He's like, what are you doing next year? I said, honestly, I have no idea. I'm finished with the system. I don't like, and I'm not going to continue in Yeshiva. Not sure if I'm going to college yet. Not sure what I'm going to do. So I'll probably find some BS job and figure out as I go on. And he paused for a second. He said, why don't you go to the Army? And I thought about it for about 5 seconds. And I said, okay. And that conversation changed my life.
Did you ask him which Army or he knew which Army?
Oh, I knew which one he was talking about.
Are you from a rabbi's home?
My grandfather was a rabbi. My father is not. My grandfather was a moel in Pittsburgh for many, many years. He did over 4,700 milot. And interestingly enough, in my time as a Pittsburgh paramedic, I saw there's a bunch of people who saw my name tag. I said, Nadoff, are you related to the rabbi Nadoff? I said, oh yeah, he's my grandfather. Oh, he taught me 1967 at Hill Academy of Pittsburgh, or he did my son's circumcision, my grandson's circumcision. It was cool just being a part of the Nadoff history in Pittsburgh, which started in 1916. But that coolness came with a side effect, which is one of the hardest calls I had was I pronounced a friend of mine's wife. But it is what it is. That's my job. It's part of my job. It's part of what I do. To go back, so after 12th grade, I went to Israel. I was 17 and a half. The first time before that, I went in, I think, that summer. before I went for the army, I spent 2 weeks in Israel. That was it. And I went back for the army. When I went back for the army, I went through the entire process and got to one last office that I had to get to. And the one lady looks at my passport, calculates my age, and says, "You can't go to the army yet. You're not 18. I said, "But the army doesn't care." I said, "No, I care. I'm not going to let you." I stayed in Israel for another 6 months, and then I drafted.
And you knew Hebrew? Was that the challenge?
So it's still a work in progress. It's still a work in progress. When I went, I can say I didn't speak a word. I was just good enough that I had to have to go to Ulpan. Thinking back, maybe I should have went. It would give me a much easier time learning, but I learned what I needed to learn in 3 months. And every time I go, I work on it. I have a couple of friends in America that all I do, we just speak in Hebrew to each other. It's a work in progress.
What did you do in the army?
In the army, I was a combat medic. There wasn't really a war when I was in 10 years ago. The only thing close to the war we had was Amud Anan. I was stationed then on the Syrian border. That was really my first taste of rockets coming in. There was no air raid sirens or anything like that because they were launching them from not even a kilometer away from us. So we knew they were coming in when the first one dropped. I remember we went up on a Friday when the war broke out then. I'll never forget that we were in the middle of a class on whatever, on different stuff that were new to the border, what to expect, things like that, rules and regulations. And we hear a, right, the little thing. And everyone throws, and my mempe looks at us with like a little smile. He's like, "All right, if this is it, this is it," right? And then we hear the impact, and then everyone breathes. We continue the conversation. And that's what life was for about 3 weeks or so until I then had a vacation. I came back to America, and I got back to Israel to find out that the army had made a mistake and wrote down the wrong times for my service. And I got back in my service. I finished a month and a half prior. Probably the first Chayal in the history of the IDF that finished his Shevut and didn't know about it.
You became a medic in the army, or you had some medic experience before?
So I think it's important to differentiate the two. In Israel, you're a paramedic or a medic, right? Chovesh, they translate in Israel as a medic. In America, you have an EMT and you have a paramedic. The differences are that it gets lost in translation is, and up until 3-4 years ago, I wasn't a paramedic. I was just a EMT. And the EMT is Israel also is comparable to a advanced EMT, or in some states it's an EMTI, an intermediate, in which an Israeli medic / chovesh can start an IV and give fluids and some medications, while an EMT basic in America cannot. I was able to do more in Israel than I was able to when I came back in America. And I got bored very easily, which is one of the reasons why I became paramedics. I actually do more.
Catch us up. Do you have a family or are you solo?
I am solo. So that's a way to put it. I am riding solo. Hey, to jump around a little bit, that's actually an interesting part. So when I went from Miluin this time, they found me. They called me up. And in that conversation, the first conversation the paramedic asked me, he said, "Are you married?" I said, "No." He said, "Good." And I went, I see where this is going. And 3 weeks later, I was in Gaza.
Where were you on October 7th?
For the past few years, every year I go to Israel for Sukkot, for Pesach, sometimes in the summer. October 7th, I was in Israel. A friend of mine is a doctor in Miluim. He invited me up to a base up north for Chag Sheni, for Simchat Torah. And I was there. We woke up and saw what was going on. That was a very weird day. Just going around, talking to everybody, trying to alleviate some anxiety that people have because people had families back down south, and so did I. And we saw every single video practically in live time. We saw everything that was going on. I was hearing reports from the military side. So I decided within 3 hours that I wasn't going back home. I texted a friend of mine who lives in Pittsburgh near my parents, and I said, "Find my father and tell him three things. Number one, what happened or what was going on right now. Number two, that I'm okay because he knew where I was for Chag. And number three, that I'm not coming back." And what started off as a week and a half long trip ended up being 4.5 months. That day, I went over to a couple of the Katsinim there. I tried to get into Miluim. It didn't work out. But I decided that I'm there now. I'm going to do something. So before I went to the base, I stopped off at a store and I bought 700 or 800 shekels worth of candy, Bisley candy, everything. And I just went around just like throwing candy at everybody the entire day, talking to them, throwing candy at them. Someone joked that I'm giving a stomach ache. And I looked at them and I said, better you have a stomach ache and think about that, think about everything else that's going on. So it was a very, very, very weird day. I have relatives in Chavez de Rome. It's near Netivot. And after like the first hour or so, I remembered them. And I start looking at the maps and seeing locations and whatever, how close everything's going. And that was the point of the day where it became personal. Because, yeah, you come after my country, fine. But you come after my family, that's different. It's not fine, but it's, you know what I mean. And that's when I decided that I was going to enlist again. And that night I started making phone calls. And the issue was that I had that a lot of American chayalim that came back was that everybody, when they got out, if you do machal, if you volunteer from Chutz La'aretz, when you get out, you're exempt from miluim. And it's hard to get that taken out, struck down. So it took me a month. During that month, I volunteered and did shmirah on a farm in the Bikal right near Jordan. And I was there for about 3 weeks until I found a yechida that was looking for me.
You went to Gaza?
Yes.
Okay, let's go there.
How did we get to Gaza? My yechida, we're an infantry unit that's attached to tanks, the Shiryon, but we go on foot and we clear houses by foot. So physically getting into Gaza, that in itself is a story. They told us the date we're going. So we're going, then it doesn't happen, right? You're going next week, it doesn't happen. You're going the week after, it doesn't happen. Finally, we got to the time when, like, we're going. Sophie's like, you're in. And they said, by noon tomorrow, we're on the bus, we're going. So noon tomorrow, all of our gear was on the bus. And we got on the bus, and we're about to pull out. And orders came in that they sit us down for 24 hours. That was a very, very weird 24 hours because we had already given our phones, we already said our last goodbyes, we already did everything. So some people didn't even turn their phones off. Like, their families have no idea that there was that 24-hour gap between that we went in, we were supposed to go in, and we did go in. But when we went in, we took a bus to some base, I forgot exactly where, and we were one of the first units into South Gaza. And we got off the bus and we walked for the first 50 hours. It was very weird. I mean, before supplies were set up, before any of that was set up. So we all ran out of water. We all ran out of food. We didn't sleep. That first night before we went in, we slept, well, for a few hours right by the fence. It was freezing. No coats, no sleeping bags, nothing, because you're ready to go. Like, we couldn't really unpack anything. And we're just like huddling and shivering, and we couldn't really huddle together because you can't. That's a big target right by the fence line. So we're spread out, and like two people were able to get together, give each other some body heat. The next morning, we got up, we went in, and within 5 hours, a bunch of us almost died. That was a sobering start to what was 50 days in Gaza, about 30 days straight, and the rest we had some breaks.
Okay, that's a very quick rundown. So when you say you were on a bus, the bus went into Gaza?
So the way it works is the bus took us to the closest base that we were going into. We staged there for a bunch of hours. We got some food, but mainly we just sat down and just waited. So our mission was to go in and secure an area of land that they've then built a logistics center to move in supplies in the first road for South Gaza. What happened was, I think it was Givati. I could be wrong on that fact. Went through the fence first and went straight into Khan Yunis. And then we went on their coattails. We waited 3-4 hours. And then we went in and secured the area. So the reasons why we had all of the holdups is because we had to wait for Givati, if that's who it was, to get to their objectives. And because we were supposed to go in a few hours after them. So we were just waiting in the cold and just waiting. And every time they get held up, because they were more fighting their way through. So whenever they get held up, we got held up. So it was basically 12 hours. It took us maybe 12, 15 hours to move a total of 15, 20 kilometers. Most of that was, I think it's half of that was on a bus, and the other half was walking, stopping, moving maybe at any given time. Like, we went a few hundred meters and stopped for 10 minutes, and a few hundred meters and stopped for a half hour, a few hundred meters and then stopped for maybe 2 hours or whatever it was. Our progress was as fast as their progress was, minus 3, 4, 5 hours, because that's what the schedule was supposed to go in after them.
So you're on foot. When are you running out of water and supplies? And when does that happen?
The first 50 hours, I mean, you're going and you carry, you only have what you can carry until they can bring in resupplies and stuff. Being that our mission was to secure the area for the resupply for everybody who was then going to be operating in South Gaza, that included us. Until we were settled and we kind of had stuff up and running, we only had what we were able to carry. And you carry 2 or 3 days worth. And that's what we had. So as time went on, before the supplies went on, we ate through all the food we had and we ate through all the, drank all the water we had.
At one point, do you start rationing?
It's rationing from the beginning. Every chayal is carrying the stuff. Every chayal, their 2 chayalim, carries exactly enough that they need for 2 days. So from the get-go, it's rationing.
Right. But when do you realize there might not be any more food or water?
When your packs are much lighter. And then it just, it's a matter of time. So we weren't far from the border. Like, we were only, because Israel's small and Gaza's even smaller. So from where we were, it was only 4 or 5 kilometers from the fence, but it was a world away. When we went, the first time we went out to see the lights in Israel, and you think to yourself that here's a bunch of lights and you can stand there without fear of being sniped, that was an emotional experience, because we just spent 27 days prior in a situation where even in the building where we were with the blacked out curtains and everything, you can only use red lights. And even then, like, still sparingly and whatever, there wasn't.
What's red light?
Instead of, you have a flasher with a white light, which you can see from miles away. Red light, it's literally that. It's a red light. And it doesn't blind you as much. It's a much softer light. And it doesn't carry as far.
Gives you more invisibility.
Yeah. So you can use it in much more of a... They knew we were there. They were watching us the whole time. They knew exactly which buildings we were, which ones we took over. But the goal was that they don't know exactly where we are in the house. So all of the windows and everything, we put up blankets and stuff. But even then, you don't want to have too much light bleeding through, because any light means you have people there and people are a target. And then you just get an RPG or whatever it is.
What stories or details are you able to share with us to put people into the experiences you've had? And I know you like to make it seem like it's not a big deal, or go through the most dramatic thing in a second and pretend like you almost missed it if you didn't miss it. But take us through it.
Because it's hard. It's hard.
I know. It's very...
It's somebody who went through it. It's like, yeah, it's like, it was my life. And to me, I went through it. Yeah, it was nerve wracking. It was this, it was that. But you're right. It is hard to see from the other side what the scary parts were or whatever it is, because what was most frustrating for a lot of us, like, isn't the fact that at any second you can get shot or sniped or anything. It was the fact that there was no running water. It was the fact that the UN 27 days are... Other people were there much longer, but we went 27 to 30 days without a shower, without a flushing toilet, without having to use a bag for your business. I mean, it's a different world. It's a very different world. It's one thing that I thought of like halfway through was that everyone talks about war, but people talk about the explosions and the death and the injuries and the casualties and all of that stuff. But there's a part of war that no one really talks about. And it's a psychological impact of not having running water, not having a toilet that flushes. That gets to you a little bit. The basic life necessities that we take for granted, that when you have them for the first time after, it's wow. We were talking amongst us, like, after the first time we went out and then came back in, a few of us, myself included, caught ourselves on the way to the bathroom looking for a bag to bring, and then remembering, oh, I don't need a bag. I'm in civilization. The toilet flushes. That first shower after that time was emotional. I guess that's the only way I can say. I stood under the water for 5 minutes before I was able to run my hands through my hair without it getting stuck. That's how much built up dust and dirt and sand is in there. Some of us had sleeping bags, but in all the houses we went into, we would come back with more mattresses and pillows and blankets and stuff. And that's what we lived with. One thing that we found delicious tea and olives in Azar. We bring it back and that's part of our stuff. And there was a lot. It was a different world. It is a different world. Being back, having civilization, it's not the simplest thing to reintegrate.
Therapists talk about that a lot.
Yeah. It's on our last day in or so, this war, the army kind of tried to get ahead of all the trauma. We had a day or two with therapists. My thing was that I don't sleep at night, even now. It's just, I don't dream, but I don't sleep well. I'll wake up from anything and then I don't even know why. And then I was up for hours. Someone else was talking about how his thing was. He doesn't feel grounded. Like his life now doesn't have an anchor anymore. He's not interested in what people have to say because it's not a because thing. It's not that what they're saying isn't interesting. But all of us got to a point where you come back from intense stress and pressure and you're coming back from that. It's hard to live in the now and it's hard to have, for lack of a better word, mundane conversations. Someone else was talking about how 4 days before he got called up, his wife gave birth to a girl and he left a 4-day-old. And he came back to 4.5-month-old that he didn't know. He didn't know his own family. People, married people came back to families and they felt they don't have a role in their household anymore. They don't know how to integrate. Their wives were doing something. Running everything for the past 4.5 months and they got back and their wives have trouble also stepping back. It's not easy. Everyone has the things that they struggle with. Part of it is the question that we were talking to each other was that, how do you live in the now and focus on the now when you know your next call up is inevitable and that has an opportunity to be so much worse?
How do you live in the now? What are you doing now? You're back in Pittsburgh?
I'm back in Pittsburgh. How do I live in the now? By working. I don't know. How am I living in the now? I'm not really living in the now. I occupy my time with work and I work all of the hours and partially because I need the money because I didn't really make much in the past year because I was in Israel and not really making much in the army. And part of it is something to occupy my time with.
And brain.
Yeah.
So, you know how every cab driver in Israel has his opinions on everything? That's how knowledgeable and opinionated everyone in Israel is. So my question for you is, in the army, with all the misguided leadership that sort of got us into this place in the first place, did you have mistrust in your leadership, in, you know, the higher up intelligence that's running and making all the decisions? Or are you like, we're going in, we're doing everything we can because they know what they're doing and they're righteous, like the Maccabees?
Once you're in it, you're in it. You don't care about the leadership. Once you're in Gaza and it's life and death, quite literally, who cares about how you got there? You're just there. So you just do. Like, as much as I can remember, didn't really have those conversations. It's just an understanding that whatever's happening, like, you're also in your own little micro part of the world, that the only way we know what's going on is like what the army's telling us. Or some people brought in like little battery powered radios. And we heard on Gal Gadot, we heard the news and stuff. That was our only window into what's going on. Could there have been frustrations? 100%. But there's no point to really talking about and getting frustrated when, what's the point? What's the point of the conversations?
The question is, do you question your commands? Or like you're sitting around waiting, you know, the hurry up and wait, it sounds a lot.
So that hurry up and wait, before we went in, people were at each other's throats. It was not, like, I remember one guy saying, how do I say goodbye to my wife again? Because this is going to be the fourth time. I can remember one of my brothers, I texted him in that 24-hour stand down, if I should tell my family, like, should I tell them? And he said, what do you mean? He said, he basically said, this will be like the fourth time. Like, why don't you tell them like when it's actually like so feet, when you're going in, that we could be ready, not bounce back and forth. I stopped for a second. I said to him, I said, "But you think this is easy for me? Like, I'm doing this for fun." Every time we say we're going in, that's the information we got. And the last time we were literally on the bus ready to go, and they sit us down for 24 hours. Different people have different perspectives and how you see it. It's frustrating for many people.
We had a wife of a Miluim Nick. She said, "I don't want to know when you're going in. Just let me know when you're out. You could text me on your way out."
Yeah. I don't think I actually told my parents that I was going in. I don't, they probably knew through everything else, whatever. I don't think I actually told them until like the week of.
Your work, did you get to do your work?
You're asking if I treated a patient well in Aza.
Yes.
So for the first time in my Army career, I actually had to treat somebody during my shirut. I ended up giving them Band-Aids. Two Band-Aids. One each. That's it. Thankfully, we didn't really have much when I was there. The Army doesn't even supply Band-Aids because if it's not a combat dressing or a tourniquet, who cares? But I knew that, so I brought my own Band-Aids. And I decided next time when I go in, I'm buying more Band-Aids, but it's all going to be Dora the Explorer and Doc McStuffins. Because there's nothing more fun than giving a big, burly guy just whatever on a mission and he's kill or be killed and you got a splinter. You give him Doc McStuffins Band-Aid. I do that at work also. Like I had any of my older patients, I'll offer them if they want a Band-Aid and I have them, I'll give them a Dora the Explorer Band-Aid. I ask them if they want it. If they want a Dora the Explorer, Doc McStuffins, a regular Band-Aid, 9 times out of 10, they want the cartoon one.
And there's a reason you pay more for it.
Exactly.
That's a good thing that you didn't see combat medic stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is. It happened around us. I mean, things were like a world away. 4 kilometers is a world away. Even 300 meters is a world away. 400 meters is a world away. There were Yechidot Machlekot not even a kilometer from us that we hear their firefights and we're listening to the radios, the reports, and some of them are getting crushed, for lack of a better word. Thankfully, we had it was a stressful thing that the first 4 hours, after the 4 hours, we went in. I now know what a bullet going past your face feels like. And having an RPG explode above your head sounds like and feels like in the general area. But actual combat, thankfully, we didn't have too much of that.
I want to ask you, there's this tough plate armor that soldiers wear to shield themselves emotionally from what's happening. So do you ever have deep, meaningful conversations when you're, you know, running out of water and food and you're putting your life on the line 24/7? Or do you just make jokes and what's the morale like?
It's mostly jokes. Because without the jokes, jokes serve a purpose. They help you out. If you can't laugh through a situation, then when you stop laughing is when the severity of it can hit. And that's an angle that you don't want to go down into. Because when you're in it, having split focus is never good. You have to stay on the mission and why you're there, what you're doing. And everyone has their reasons on why they're there. And that's what you focus on.
So no one had emotional breakdowns on off times?
In Aza itself, to the best of my knowledge, no. I mean, some people got upset, but not a debilitating extent.
Back to the no water, no food. So when you actually ran out, how long was it till you got supplies?
I don't know if we got very, very low. I don't remember if we actually ran out. Honestly, the first week or so is a blur. I don't really remember it much.
Is there anything else you would like to share you feel is important?
100%. Coming back, I talked about the reintegration into society, how hard it is. There is a organization that I'm a part of that actually is based in Muncie called Nivut. Nivut was started by Ari Abramowitz, who, when he came back, he realized that for a Chayal Boded coming back to America, there isn't a support group. So he created one and started with a bunch of friends getting together and just hanging out and then having Shabbatonim and stuff like that. And it morphed into a international organization. We have chapters in the US and in England and some in Israel and all over. We have 2 full-time on-staff psychologists. We give money for therapy. We give money for job training, resume building. We give money for education grants. Get-togethers, Shabbatonim, one of the amazing things about it is when October 7th happened, after Chag finished, he opened up a war room in his house. His house is the headquarters for the organization. His basement has a bunch of beds for Shabbatonim and stuff. And for a week, pretty much 24/7, he had four people there, raising money, looking for flights, getting sued. Any Chayil Boded as part of the organization that wanted to go back, stop off, pick up a gear bag with shirts, boxers, socks, a bulletproof vest, food, anything that they would need, and for free, just pick it up and go. And then every few months, they send two or three or four people with like 19 suitcases to go around the country to all of our chayilim that were there, that are there, and give them more tziud. The first mission, I had to actually use my car. I had rented a minivan then. We loaded it up and we went. Our area was in the south. And it wasn't just chayilim bodidim. Like once we started, like we realized that everybody needs some stuff. So we drive around. I remember two things. Number one, we went to stop at a gas station to get something. And there was a bunch of chayilim there in a Hummer. And I went over to them. I was talking to them. I said, "You guys need any tziud?" And they said, "What do you have?" I said, "No, we're not going to play that game. Tell me what you need and I'll tell you if we have it." They gave me a list. And one of the things I said, we need, none of us have headlamps. And he said, I said, "Okay, jump to my car. This is, what are you talking about?" I said, "Just follow me. Stop asking questions." One of them followed me and we opened up a thing. I slammed my duffel bags down, unzipped it, and his jaw dropped. And everything they needed, we gave them.
What are headlamps?
Flashlights for, yeah. There's another one. We pulled in through Sderot and we were just happened to be passing through. And there's a block over there and there's a border police there. I rolled down my window. I was driving to explain what we were doing because the whole place was kind of blocked off. And the first thing he says to me, he says, "Hey, do you want pizza?" Look, I said, "Pizza? Wait, we're here to give stuff to you. Why are you offering us pizza?" He said, "Someone just dropped off 70 pies and we don't know what to do with it. We're only six people." So we pulled over, we had pizza. And again, man, so what kind of gear do you need? What do you have? What do you need? And they told me they needed, and we gave everybody what they needed. It's a great organization that does tremendous, tremendous stuff. It's really, it's by Chayilim Bodidim for Chayilim Bodidim. It's not only reserves. We have a few people that are in now. We're trying to start a new initiative to get people who are thinking about going, starting up a mentorship program, someone to follow them throughout their entire service, and then welcome them back into the family. When they get back to America, we sent probably 100 chayilim to Israel.
Reservists.
Right. And everyone got a bulletproof vest. Everyone got a flight. Most of them got a flight. Some people got their own flights, found other things. 2 weeks ago, maybe it's last week, we had a Shabbaton in Hunter Mountain. It was like 80 of us with spouses and kids and whatever and families. And we got together and talked. Therapy sessions for the chayilim, therapy sessions for the spouses.
And everyone's happy to do therapy? No one's like too, I don't need this stuff.
I think it comes to a certain point where you realize that, no. So actually, it isn't easy for some to talk. I opened up the evening Friday night and I spoke. I was the first speaker. And I spoke about that and I brought it up. And after that, people started opening up. And a few people came over to me and said, "Thank you for talking, because if you hadn't talked, I wouldn't have been able to." And how do you do that? How are you first? And I looked at them and said, "I'm first, so then you can have an opportunity." Because I know that certain people can't, and I'm willing to take the first hit so other people can open up and get the help that they need.
What did you share? Anything you didn't share with us already?
I had two main targets in my speech. Number one was talking about joy and happiness and the need to find it. And then the second part was going back to a lot of people feeling that society doesn't understand them when they come back. And I sent a text to a few of my friends and asked them, "What would you say to the chayal who comes back and doesn't feel like they have a place in society anymore?" I got back a few responses. I read them and it was part of the speech. One of the responses that I read was actually from Michael Milch, who was on your show a couple months ago. He sent me back a beautiful, beautiful piece, and it went over really, really well.
Could you tell us in a few sentences?
I can find it and read it, the whole thing, its entirety, if you want.
I don't know how long your speech is.
You know what? So we'll start it, and we'll see how far we get.
Okay.
"Hey, fam. I look around the room And that's what I see, a family. I recently saw a definition of family, which is having someone to love you unconditionally in spite of you and your shortcomings. And that's what Nevut truly is, a family. Now, a little about me. I am from Pittsburgh. My family has been here since 1916. I served in the IDF in 2013, 2014. I was a combat medic, and after I worked in nursing homes, and I was a Pittsburgh paramedic, and most recently a soldier in Gaza. Coming out is hard. Going back to your family is hard. Going back to your job is hard. It's important throughout all of this to be happy. As humans, one of the things that we need in order to survive and thrive is happiness. In fact, it's one of the very things that the founders of this country saw fit to include in the document that declared our independence, the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. But it is hard, so hard, to find joy in the darkness. Every one of us has been through things that most people cannot even fathom. Myself, I almost died within the first 4 hours of getting into Gaza. All of this, it changes you. I want to tell you a story about a Chayal who had issues when he got out of the army 10 years ago. A Chayal who had a friend that started noticing the issues who said, "Achi, I don't know what it is, but you're different. You're not the same person who left. You need to get help." And the Chayal ignored it. He ignored the advice and continued on the path he was on, the path of darkness. And only after he systematically destroyed every relationship that he had, including those with his family and parents, only then did he realize that there was an issue and went to get help. I know this story because that Chayal was me. Because of my own experience is why I support everything Nevut, why I've gotten my friends and family involved in Nevut, because this didn't exist when I came out. This family didn't exist. I know that in normal speeches, you save the thank you for the end, but this is not a normal speech and these are not normal times. So Ari, thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for creating something so important and life-saving. Everyone here owes you a debt of gratitude. I think it's obvious why I'm speaking about joy, but I want to delve into this a little bit more. After we got out of Gaza, we had a conversation with each other and talked about things that we struggle with the most. Some people talked about how they felt their life didn't have meaning, that they don't know what they should do, that they feel like they have no anchor, that they don't feel grounded. Others talked about how they feel that they can't connect to normal people anymore. They just don't care what they're talking about. Others talked about how when they came home, they got back to a four-month-old child that when they left was 4 days old and they don't know their child. All of these are hard stories, but I think that there is a common link between them, and that is the lack of happiness. You can say that happiness and joy comes from a sense of belonging, something that a lot of us are struggling with. So I had a thought. I texted a few friends and asked them to send me a few lines for the soldier who may think that society doesn't understand them. And this is what I got back. One wrote, "It may sound odd, but many of us in Schutzlaritz envy the lone soldiers and veterans of the IDF. We know it must be difficult to leave your families, jobs, and comfort, not to mention the very real dangers of combat. But we Jews value life above all, and there is literally no greater merit in saving and protecting lives. Be strong and know that every one of us, whether directly connected or love you, care about your well-being, appreciate your sacrifices, and respect your service to Am Yisrael." Another one wrote, "Wherever you are, please know that you are in our hearts and prayers and are never alone. You are in our minds with every Israel update that we read. You are in our thoughts when we think of a silly joke that only you'd appreciate 7,000 miles away. And we'll then check WhatsApp repeatedly on the off chance that we can catch as much as a notification that you've read our message. We are proud to know you or even be associated with you for your service and your sacrifice, and furious at those who try to thwart you and put you in harm's way. Please know that you are never alone, and we count the milliseconds until you and all of our brothers are truly safe." Another wrote, "War in Israel is very difficult at times for people living in America. We can't necessarily relate. I've had the tremendous opportunity of traveling to Israel. This is now my fourth time since October 7th. And being able to spend time with the soldiers, the wounded soldiers, and the people that were impacted by the war. I went to hospitals, I met with hostages that were released and hostages' families of those hostages who have not been released. I spent time with all these groups of people, and I have a real appreciation for what each and every one of you are doing. Not only for the ones that live permanently in the land of Israel, but every lone soldier, especially those coming from America and other areas of the diaspora, fight for a land that is ours, to fight alongside their brothers and sisters, to protect their brothers and sisters, to protect our land. It is the most unbelievable thing and the most absolutely inspiring thing. The notion of leaving the comforts of your home and traveling to Israel to go to war is not something the average American or even the average Israeli can fathom. So when that happened, the immediate thought is, that's a hero. I've been able to live a little bit vicariously through you and through some of the other lone soldiers that I know and who take the risk, their lack of fear, their bravery that these soldiers have and are willing to expend to go and fight alongside their Israeli brothers and sisters to protect our land and our people is unbelievable. Saving one life is the equivalent of saving hundreds of lives. And so to all the lone soldiers, and in many ways, even more importantly, because most of the soldiers are so unbelievably humble, even more so to their family members and friends who that give up so much for them to go, that worry about them tirelessly, that worry that they might not come home, to those members of the family that of those that did not come back, we are with you. Whatever you need, we are with you. We pray for you. And we think about you. All the lives that have been lost are not taken for granted. Each and every one of them are remembered. So kol hakavod to all of the lone soldiers and all the family members and friends of lone soldiers who devote their lives to the protection of the state of Israel and the Jewish people. You will be remembered as true Maccabees of this generation, saving Israel and its people from wickedness and from terrorism. It is so true what they all said. We are never alone, and we are the Maccabees of this generation. I want to pause for a moment and would ask everyone here to look around the room and know that we are all in this together and that we are all here for each other, because Nevut isn't just for a time. Nevut is for life. I want to leave you with one last message. Take it from somebody who knows. Take it from somebody who has been there. Take it from somebody who is there. Don't do this alone. Get the help that you need to find the joy, a real joy, an everlasting joy.
I appreciate you sharing that with us.
So in a nutshell, that's what Nevut is. That's what we do. We provide a opportunity for people who need the help to get the help in whatever way it is.
Do you have survivor's guilt?
The rational part of me says no. The irrational part of me says maybe.
Anything you discovered in therapy?
If I started going yet, then maybe.
You're promoting something you're not doing yourself.
Part of therapy is talking about it, because the makeup of PTSD in part is the brain's inability to process it. You process things by talking about it. So just the very fact that people talk about it helps you process it, which doesn't mean I won't go to a therapist. It's on the schedule for next week. But you can do a lot with just talking to people and talking amongst yourselves.
Hopefully tonight is helpful.
100%.
Can you share the feelings or thoughts that you had when you learned that you're coming back?
Coming back to America?
Getting out of Gaza.
There was a palpable difference. I have videos from the second time I went in. I brought my phone, turned off location. I have videos from while we were there, and videos from the last day. There's a palpable difference in the atmosphere on the last day. People were genuinely happier. It's the light at the end of the tunnel. It's a relief. We're here. And then when you get out, then you're stuck back there a little bit, or thinking about the next step a little bit, and everyone finds their own way to cope.
You didn't talk about your near-death experience at all.
Within the first 4 or 5 hours when we got in, there was some Hamas sneak waiting in a house. They opened fire on us. We got both bullets and RPGs. And then afterward, one of the returning fire, so we're all racked up against the wall. And a guy 3 or 4 or 5 bodies behind me opens fire over my head. Back to thing. And I remember his face, and he was a little panicked. And I thought to myself, I'm like, okay, well, this is cool. Forget about shooting from there. They're shooting from here, and whatever. It is what it is. Enough people yelled at him that he stopped shooting.
That's like rule number one when you're shooting, to make sure no one is in.
Yes, it is rule number one. But also, in his defense, when you're in combat and it's a thing, it's high pressure.
You had a gun?
Yes. Yeah, you don't go into Gaza without a gun. The basic difference between me and everybody else is that in 99.9% of the cases, I won't be on an entry team to the house. I'll be after. But for all other intents and purposes, I'm a lochem until somebody needs medical part.
So you're a regular soldier until you need to wear your medic hat.
Yeah.
I was just in Israel. I might have mentioned that to you. And I had an impression from using the porta potties when I was there. So when you were talking a little bit about your experiences in Gaza.
It's not a porta, trust me.
It's not a porta potty.
Having to look for a literal bag. And when you run out of bags, it's not fun. You have to find having to find bags. It's actually interesting. It's two different things. Because in one of the places where we were after we secured it and whatever, after the first month, they actually brought in porta potties. And I used one of them before we left. And I was struck by the smell. Because when you use a bag, it's self-contained and you toss it outside. And you know, it's out of sight, out of mind. And it's just like, I kind of prefer the bag.
No, they're pretty bad. And you don't realize until you're on the base. And we weren't even in Gaza. I mean, we got there and we're like, you're 20 minutes away from Gaza. And I just started crying.
20 minutes gets loud too. I mean, Gaza was very loud also. We all lost hearing there. I lost hearing. Everyone lost hearing.
Well, all the words that were shared with you and that you read and shared with us, they're very true. And even when everyday people are talking about everyday things, we're still deeply in thought and in connection, in tremendous debt and gratitude to heroes like you. It really feels like we get to live amongst heroes now, and you get to see them every day. And
thank you.
I'm so grateful for your time today. And
a pleasure.
I think these little bits of information and experiences that you share with us help bridge that gap between soldiers who come home, thankfully, and the rest of us.
Which is the very reason that I'm here. I don't necessarily, I'm good at speaking. I'm good at speech writing. I don't necessarily like it. But my thought was, when you asked me to be on the show, was my first thought was, no, I'm not doing it. I don't like it. I don't want to. And then I told myself, it's the same reason that I tell everybody else is why I do it. Because it's not for me, it's for them. So if one person sees this and that enables them to get help or work through it, then it makes it worth it.
Well, I thought you just listened to everything Ellie tells you to do. It's like going to the army.
No, only the stuff that can get me killed.
Okay. One thing I didn't get to. Do you have a minute?
Of course.
Your relationship with God or religion, has anything changed?
See, that's a question that can't be summed up in a few words. That's another entire topic in itself. But if I would have to, yes and no. In some ways, it's stronger, in some ways, it's weaker. Word changes you. I always believed, I always will believe. In practice, it changes a little bit. It's a hard question to answer.
Okay, maybe we'll do a part two.
Maybe in part, yeah. Because maybe in part is I'm still sorting through it. And I'll be sorting through it for a long time.
Well, when you speak to, I'm not comparing you to an addict, but when you speak to the addict, you're supposed to say, when is your next meeting? So as we log off today, I'll say, when are you going to therapy? Are you going to go next week?
Oh, yeah, it's already scheduled.
Already scheduled.
It's already scheduled. And I have a few friends also that are therapists, and I talk to them on a personal level, not a professional level, but it definitely helps. It definitely helps.
Thank you, Isaac.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening until the end. If you have feedback or comments, please do reach out. If you'd like to join the WhatsApp group, reach out as well. And have a great week. See you next time.